Hello, everyone. Welcome to Delos, where you are able to live out your wildest fantasies in Roman world, medieval world, or Western world. Why is it not called West world? It doesn't even make sense. Why have Delos called it Western world and the movie is called Westworld? Explain that one to me.
It's one of those film anomalies. It's like the same reason why the song What a Girl Wants is not in the movie What a Girl Wants.
It just doesn't make any sense at all. Welcome back to It's a Wonderful Podcast. We are very excited, even a little bit annoyed, though we are today, about that stupidness within this movie. To talk about this movie and continue our cross-series cyborg sci-fi movies that we are talking about. Moving into the 70s, the early 70s is a particularly prolific time in sci-fi movie making, when American movies, of course, decided they wanted to get nastier, to get more grounded, to get more violent, and all in all, provide just very entertaining silliness a lot of the time. And I think Westworld really does provide entertaining silliness, although there was one particular element to Westworld that struck me quite significantly. I was going to say like a brick to the face, but I felt that was a little bit violent, even maybe as appropriately violent as it might have been for this movie, which is at times impressively violent. And
pretty gruesome,
I like
that
about it, because it should be. A movie like this really, really should be. But we are light years away from the sci-fi of Metropolis and Forbidden Planet. Now, this grand, huge scale of epic storytelling sci-fi and philosophical ideas. No, we're in the grungier side of sci-fi. This is almost your precursor to what we have spoke about on Morgan Hasn't Seen during this month. A RoboCop, or even a Blade Runner, I suppose, which was, of course, this week's episode of Morgan Hasn't Seen. Very exciting that was. But I am excited about Westworld. I was looking forward to watching Westworld for the first time, Ginny, 1973, for this episode. What do we think of it to begin with?
I mean, generally, I think it's a great premise. I think that's why the show was so successful, because, you know, it had those episodes in the room to really develop the story, kind of see more behind the scenes of the people who created Westworld, and then implant more depth with the malfunction that happens. So because, you know, you have that wiggle room for the storytelling, I think the show ended up being far more compelling than this movie. But, you know, the show wouldn't be the show without starting out with such a great base idea of this book turned into a movie. So for this movie being as low budget as it was, I think it ended up having like a $1.5 million budget. I think they did a really good job of just executing a really simple, straightforward story. You know, I love when you can kind of reference things that come later in film. So, you know, in terms of Yul Brynner's character and his malfunction, we get a bit of a Terminator essence kind of happening.
Very much
But, you know, this film does kind of lack the suspense that it could have when we get to kind of our big takeover finale. They kind of rush through it. So I kind of wish they would have taken time with that. But overall, because the idea is so good, it helps sell this movie. And just kind of knowing, you know, how low budget it was, I think what they're able to do with that, I think it really sells this premise pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm talking about when I said I had one thing that hit me like a brick to the face, which was really how simple this movie is.
Yeah,
it is. Stunningly straightforward movie. And as you said, there was, of course, the Westworld TV show, the HBO show, which wasn't that long ago at all, really, was it? It's only a few years ago, although I think it does no longer exist.
No, I don't think so. I think it had maybe 3 seasons. I think I only watched like 1.5. Like I watched the full first season, really enjoyed it. And then the story kind of got a little bit more complex and complicated. And I think I ended up watching like the first half of season 2. But, you know, people said it was great. So, you know, it's always one on that list to kind of go back and finish or rewatch. So,
yeah, I admittedly never watched it. And I think I would definitely be interested in watching it now after having watched this movie, because I can only assume it's a far more, well, you've just said it's a far, far more deeper, far more kind of exploratory show that gets into the, maybe the psyche of the robots themselves, the psyche of those creators of the robots, the Delos themselves, or whatever they may be called. I assume it's still Delos.
Yeah, and the creator is Anthony Hopkins, plays kind of the creator of everything.
Yeah. So I assume it's just taking the really great ideas that are presented to us in the movie and just actually having the time to explore
flesh
them
it out
deeper. Yeah. And I wish this movie at times would have done a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But in realizing that, I don't think it ever really wanted to, because it presented itself as a scenario style movie. Robots get malfunctioned in a theme park and go crazy. And it's really all about the kind of pitfalls of overcreating, of assuming your own genius and everything's under control, and then it just becoming totally out of control.
Yes. And I think the fact that it kind of is straightforward, it doesn't go into too much detail as to why they glitch. There's not really an understanding of it. There's not really an explanation as to what makes this switch happen. It feels a little bit very much like how I described last week with Forbidden Planet, that it felt almost like an episode of The Twilight Zone or an episode of a kind of show like that, a sci-fi show, in terms of just kind of telling a quick story and getting to your kind of twist ending.
Yeah.
Without really delving into any deeper explanation, because it's kind of a one-off scenario.
Yeah. It's the fact that the malfunction happens at all is what's interesting, not why it happens.
Why? Yeah.
Because the fact it happens makes us think, oh yeah, let's not pretend to play God and do all this kind of thing. Yes. Also, Michael Crichton clearly just loves malfunctioning theme parks.
Yeah, definitely.
Jurassic Park and Westworld. I mean, he wrote and directed this movie.
Yeah.
He didn't quite go that far with Jurassic Park.
No, he felt like, because I think he had only directed maybe like one other like TV thing before this. Okay. So, yeah, I think he kind of learned his lesson and was like, yeah, maybe we should get somebody else. Who definitely knows what they're doing to direct that movie.
It's a great idea. And I suppose Jurassic Park does go a little bit deeper into maybe why this is being done. And
we have Ian Malcolm there to kind of, we have him kind of break down like why this change occurs, and just kind of explaining the development of these creatures and, you know, the evolution of just it being kind of a natural thing with the science. But here, there's not really any of that. And there's not really a lot of, like, we even have kind of the main scientist saying like, well, I don't know how it works. So it's like, what?
Pretty much. But I think what we're dealing with in Westworld is ultimately a kind of shock sci-fi horror.
Yes.
Where you are just wanting it to be as simple as it ends up being, because that's what the movie's trying to be. That's where it's trying to be effective. It's trying to put you in James Brolin and Richard Benjamin's shoes that end up loving their time in Westworld, getting really into it, being a little bit tentative in the back of your mind, you know, mainly.
Until you kind of get used to it.
Until you get used to it. Are you actually having fights with real people or robots? They look so lifelike. Have I just shot a man? And, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Yes, it wants to leave you with that thing right in the back of your mind. It wants to keep it there, chipping away at you right up until it does change and you are thrust into a chase, a Terminator-style chase, as you said before, that it does very, very much become, because Yul Brynner's gunslinger is pretty relentless for the last half an hour of this movie.
He's just strutting, we'll get into the strutting.
Yes, he is constantly at Richard Benjamin, and it is quite terrifying. It becomes a Michael Myers, a slasher chase almost, doesn't it? And it's you can't get away, and that's the terror of Westworld. That's the shock of Westworld, and I think it does that really, really very well, and, you know, is such a great window into early 70s sci-fi for doing that, because early 70s, well, 70s movies anyway, 70s American movies anyway, want to be very much about the horror of people, the grittiness, and the small-scale, individual story rather than the larger, grander scale ideas that we've talked about in the other two sci-fi movies we've covered on this main show.
Yes.
It fits the mold really, really well. And I like it for that. It is, as we say, of its time and wonderfully so, because you can't have this movie with this ideas, with this execution at any other time than the early 70s. But watching it, knowing all that, just makes you really, really enjoy it. You're not trying to think any more about it than it wants to give you, because you recognize what it wants to give you is exactly what it should be giving you.
Yes.
At the time it comes out, which is just wonderful. But before we get into any more discussion of Westworld, we do have to say a big thank you to our It's a Wonderful Podcast patrons, of course, as we always like to do every week on one of the shows here on the It's a Wonderful Podcast feed. You can join them and join us on the Patreon, or donate if you want to support us in that way. There are links in the description of this episode to go and do that. We would love you forever. We certainly would, much like Janine. We love and want to say thank you to Adam Witt.
And thank you, Michael Smith.
Thank you to Abby Friel.
Thank you, Ferris Muthana.
Thank you, 90s Comics Box, Janine's big brother, Justin.
Thank you, Tina Farrow.
Thank you to Marcus Burton.
Thank you to Movie Fenobi Steve.
Thank you, Sir Mia Tesfai.
Thank you, Patrick Harden.
Thank you to Carla Fies.
Thank you to the great Ken Knapsack.
Thank you to Tom and Kimber of the Odd Shape Channel.
Thank you, Eric Garcia.
And thank you, of course, to Billy Pollahan. Yes. Yay. We love the patrons. They are great. Do we love this movie? I think we do. I know we say it's simple, it's straightforward. We wish it would have perhaps been a little deeper than it was, but I think when you can look past that and realize that it never actually wanted to be any deeper than its own scenario, we can appreciate it for just being fun, really. It's fun, it's entertaining, and it's nasty, and it's relentless. That's kind of great, right?
And I mean, I think the opening is really fun. It adds this interesting layer to kind of open us up to this world immediately. It opens with this kind of commercial almost. We have this reporter kind of talking to people as they leave the Delos Corporation or whatever, and asking them, you know, what world did you visit? Oh, I went to, you know, Roman world, and it was great. You know, all the gorgeous Roman men. Oh my goodness, I had the best time ever. And so then they kind of just interview these people as they come out from the different places and ask them, you know, their experience. And everyone has this, you know, glowing review of the different places, different worlds they got to visit. So that's this kind of setup commercial for this company. And then we get right into our two travelers heading to Westworld. So, and I like that we have one that's kind of experienced. The friend is asking all these kind of silly questions. You know, and it adds to kind of this nice, it gives you this light comedic tone almost. So when things do shift, you know, it's an interesting juxtaposition. So I like the lightness of how they open this movie, really diving us right in, you know, giving us this glowing review of this experience for people. And then we jump in, we jump right into people traveling there. So it's very light to open.
Yeah, I mean, I do like that it does that. And I mean, I still think it immediately, even with this commercial, does just put in your mind the ethics of what's going on. The idea of going to a vacation theme park where you can basically do anything you want in this time world that you are in. You know, Roman world, medieval world, West world, whatever you want to go to, you are basically free to do whatever you want with no consequences. Kill people, beat people up, you know, sleep with as many people as you want.
Yeah, be the good guy, be the bad guy. Yeah, and then they even tell you, like, how much it costs. Like, do you think this experience, they ask kind of the crowd at the end of the commercial, do you think this experience is worth $1,000 a day? And everyone's like, yeah. So so you're getting the sense of how this works, how much it costs. And, you know, so you're already setting up this high level for what this experience is going to be.
So it's
a really great setup, I think.
No, it is. And I think, as we say, the lightness of, or what, you know, what you speak about, the lightness, the kind of genial conversation between James Brolin and Richard Benjamin as they are traveling to Delos facility and obviously then on to Westworld themselves is a great mix of that with these kind of almost terrifying ideas when you actually peel back the layers and realize that this is just a free-for-all place for people. Like, I can't get that out of my mind when I'm watching this movie. I can't get that out of my mind when I put on this movie. So yes, okay, I like the comedic side of it. I like them going to Westworld, choosing all the little outfits to wear and trundling off down, you know, the street that I think is the same high street from High Noon. Like to point that out. I think it's the same set, which I love that something like that can be reused for something.
Yeah, like I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, in that time, I'm sure those sets were still up and it was still kind of a working lot that people could use and all of that. So, you know, not surprising.
It's great to see them walk around and go and, you know, order drinks at the bar, get into a bar fight where we first meet Yul Brynner's gunslinger, and he just kind of acts as a annoyance, really, doesn't he, to the guests of Westworld. He's there to basically be somebody they're supposed to fight.
Yeah.
And that's his role as the robot he is. And it all seems very, very fun, but I just like watching it within the underlayer of looking at all the behind the scenes people that we do cut to quite often, sitting on the computers, you know, making sure all the communications are going right, making sure all the robots are where they should be.
Yeah,
the even times that things are right. It's really, really strict and stringent, and I loved seeing all that.
The inner workings.
Because it just reminds you. Yeah, it reminds you that it's actually a terrifyingly uncanny place. This is not a nice, fun vacation. This is Disneyland if the characters didn't look like somebody in a Mickey Mouse suit, if it actually looked like a human being and you didn't quite know if it was a human being or not.
Yes. So I do like that they also give us this kind of factor to where you can at least tell them apart. It's because they have this ribbing on their hand. They couldn't quite get that right. So at least there's a one kind of defining factor that you just look at their palm to know. But other than that, it's super uncanny. And then, you know, when you really think about it, they're not really getting the true experience of those time periods, because this is like a lush luxury version. Like, it's not all dirty and grimy or anything like that. Like, everything looks pretty pristine and clean. So it's
like
kind
pseudo
of
this, dirty.
Yes. So it's literally just kind of this pleasure cruise version of what that would really be like. So you're not really getting the full experience. Again, it's just this playground to kind of do whatever you want. But I like what you said about, you know, this uncanniness of the reminder of the behind the scenes people making sure everything works. Because we see several scenes at night of, you know, something malfunctioning. And while all the guests are kind of asleep, our scientists and you know, people behind the scenes will come out of the shadows and like take that thing away and work on it and kind of set up staging for the next day. So I like that.
Never spoiling the illusion for the guests.
Yes. They wait until it's dark and then they'll go in there and do what they need to do and get out and make sure everything just looks just so for the next day. So I like that.
Think about Disneyland reminders. I said it does actually remind you of Disneyland quite a lot.
Oh, yeah.
We know Disneyland to have its underground tunnels and backdoor entrances to things and how people
So you don't see
around.
People like pushing around big bags of trash and things like that.
Whenever I am reminded of these kind of things, for some reason it fascinates me. And I think that it's what fascinated me about Westworld the most. But it also does terrify me because it is purely an entire organization putting on a performance for the pleasure of those paying to be there.
Yeah.
That I'd rather see what's actually going on. I think just because it makes me feel comfortable knowing that it's all fake. And that's the point of this movie. That's the point of what Westworld is trying to make you think. Like, do you become too comfortable within Westworld, within medieval world,
within
Roman world?
Yes, with these artificial things, yeah.
And I like that we see quite a decent enough chunk of medieval world and Roman world as well. I wasn't expecting that. I didn't even know we were getting that because I'd never seen Westworld before. But I like that we get it because it gives a different kind of impression on the goings on in those other worlds. It's much the same, but there's tiny little differences and there's tiny little different ways in which the illusion has to be kept up. And it's, you know, the guests there ultimately want to do different sort of things. Like, you can't do the exact same things you do in medieval world in Westworld, obviously. You have to go about them in a little bit of a different way. If you want to have a fight with somebody, it has to be a sword duel, not a standoff in the middle of a huge
town. And there's a whole kind of story narrative behind it. You know, you have to kill the king so you can run away with the queen and all of this kind of storyline. So there's this fun kind of build up to the story of what you are set up to do if that's what you choose to do. So, I mean, we even see that in Westworld with our two guys kind of, you know, they have they see this chaos happening, like a bank robbery. And James Brolin's just like, man, no, let's just go to the brothel. Like, I'm trying to do no bank robbing. Like, but yeah. Richard Benjamin is all about like, no, I want to explore. I want to experience like everything and do all of these things. I think it'll be fun. And, you know, no, James Brolin just like, nah, brothel.
But again, I mean, it brings up the idea of, are they being pushed to do certain things? Is it as, you know, is it as much about their own free will as it perhaps appears to be? Maybe yeah. I'm reading a little bit too far into it. I don't think I am.
I think it definitely makes it feel like it's a choose your own adventure kind of experience.
But it's really they
set up these different scenarios and you can either choose to participate or not. But they kind of maybe you do go on this rotation every day. So like every day at whatever time, that's when the bank robbery is going to happen. So if you want to be in mixed in with that and save the day, that could be part of your story. Or if you want to just go hook up with some ladies, go for that as well. But I do like that there is, you know, Richard Benjamin, he seems really enthusiastic and excited. He's asking James Brolin all these questions like, can I do this? What do you wear? What's this kind of gun called? You get to choose your gun. Does it have real bullets? He's asking all these questions. He's really curious. He's really excited. He seems like he wants to get involved in everything. But I do like that there's this hesitancy from him when they do kind of go to the brothel and, you know, he meets a lady and they go to hook up. He's really nervous and he feels strange about having this kind of level of connection with one of these things. So I do like that he's not just kind of like jumps into it like all willy-nilly. He really kind of has some concerns. He's a little bit nervous. He's kind of talking, you know, I just want to let you know, like talking to this girl like she's a person. And he really is scared and doesn't really understand how it all works. So I think at least we needed some of that because it felt too easy. Like it felt like How do you go into this situation? Sure, the idea of it seems fun, getting to do whatever you want, experience things however you want. But, you know, there has to be people who, once they get there, have to think, this is kind of weird. This is strange. These aren't human people, but I'm interacting with them in this way. I'm getting intimate with them. Like,
how they does look all like that work? Human beings.
Yes, they look
I'm
like
so
people.
Confused.
Yes, like, you know, if you're looking for a genuine connection, you're not really going to get that. So I like that we had one of our leading characters really questioning that for a bit and really trying to understand and having to kind of build himself up to experience something like that. So I think we needed something like that to make these characters feel more relatable, because not every character is going to be like a kid in the candy store. They're going to have questions and concerns and really feel a little bit weird about all of this to some degree.
And the great thing about Richard Benjamin's kind of story in this movie is right when he becomes most comfortable in the world of Westworld and kind of gets over his confusion of, am I talking to a real person? No, wait, I'm not talking to a real person. It just really, really, really feels like I'm talking to a real person. He's right as the malfunction happens, and then he assumes everybody's just going to go along with what he wants to do because he's the guest. But no, because they've all malfunctioned now, so Yul Brynner just decides to kill people.
Yes. So, I mean, we already kind of see these little glimmers and they show us bits of malfunctions when the scientists and guys, you know, behind the scenes are, you know, noticing different glitches and they're bringing robots in and like things aren't working or they're repeating things or they're not operating correctly. And they really don't understand what's going on. But the kind of the lead scientist, he's very much like trying to figure it out. He's getting concerned. Everyone's telling him, oh no, it's not a big deal. We'll figure it out. It's just a little glitch. But as more and more things start malfunctioning, we see him kind of get more concerned, but he's still very much not having any kind of sense of urgency. So that is a little bit of a disappointment as well, because I think that him kind of maybe panicking but maybe trying to hide it, I think would have been better than him really feeling like something's wrong, not really saying anything, and everyone just convincing him it's fine, because he's kind of the guy in charge. So I would have liked him to maybe be a little bit more panicked, but showing him try to like put on a brave face for everyone else or something like that, rather than kind of how they played it with him kind of just, oh, well, okay. I mean, I think something's wrong, but all my people are saying it's good, so I guess it's good, kind of.
You know, well, maybe this is the thing. Maybe he, as the leader of what's going on here, he has become delusional in himself and assumes, yes, we know what we're doing. It'll all be fine. We have malfunctions every day. We just deal with it and move on. This is nothing out of the ordinary. Perhaps he is just not taking it as seriously as it might perhaps should be.
Yeah.
Simply because he is too adamant of the genius of what they're doing at Delos. And isn't that the kind of moral message of this movie?
Yeah, I guess
kind of it just is. Don't be like that.
Yes, kind of just this god complex of being able to create these realistic, almost human-like things. And having it go so well for so long. So when something like this happens in this kind of wave of malfunctions, it would be hard for someone to kind of think that, oh, you know, it's just a fluke. It's just a one-time situation. It's worked well every time. So, you know, this can't be a serious issue. But, you know, you see it growing and building when more things get wrong. And he still kind of has the same temperament, like, throughout all of that. So
he does, but there's even, like, boardroom meetings, isn't there, where they're talking about the spike of malfunctions in various worlds. Like, oh, we had a real spike in Roman world about 2 months ago. Now that seems to have transitioned onto Westworld.
Yeah.
How can we combat this? I don't know how we can combat this. And they're all kind of pontificating with each other about what they may be able to do about these malfunctions. Perhaps we'll shut it down. Oh, but no, we can't shut it down. Then we'll lose a load of money. Well, perhaps we just won't allow any new guests to come. Those that have already booked can still come. But we just won't have any new ones for a few months until we sort this out. Because we will definitely sort it out. Oh, yes, we'll definitely figure this out. We're too good to not figure this out. Well, are they too good to not?
Yes, that's kind of god
definitely
complex.
Definitely not.
These scientists have, and then
have all the control.
Yes, and then you know, even with the violence that kind of happens as well, it seems like it's, you know, it's feeling like it's staged, like it's part of the show. You know, Yul Brynner's gunslinger keeps popping back up, trying to fight somebody in a duel. Our guys are always able to one-up him. So I like that there's a build to what ultimately happens, because I think there's at least maybe 2 or 3 different occasions where the gunslinger comes, there's a big standoff, and one of our guys is able to take him out quickly. And then they just move on with the rest of their experience.
I love this structure of it. To get 2 little quick things out of the way, James Brolin, I really like James Brolin as an actor. I always like him when he shows up in things, when I watch movies with James Brolin in. However, I don't like him without a beard.
Yeah, he looks better
with a beard. And I think he looks much better with facial hair. However, somebody who does have lovely facial hair in the movie is Richard Benjamin, the actual lead, I suppose, of the movie. Mustache Hall of Fame worthy mustache.
Oh,
I think.
Hey, yes, I would agree. I would definitely
quite a long time.
Yes, it's been a bit since we've had somebody, but no, he looks great with a mustache. He pulls it off really well. But yeah, I mean, we start to get these glimmers of things going wrong amongst the guests. So at a certain point, it's kind of only the scientists seeing the glitches, and they've been able to hide it pretty well from the guests. But now the guests are kind of starting to see things. James Brolin gets bitten by a snake. which is not, it's not supposed to do something like that. When Richard Benjamin is with one of the ladies, we kind of, they kind of, you know, zoom in on her eyes and show this kind of sinister kind of glint happen in her eyes. And things like that.
The white, just kind of glint.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, very similar to Blade Runner, you know, what they
very similar to Blade.
Yes. So just kind of our signifier that something's off. And then, you know, we get this kind of big bar brawl breakout where everybody's fighting and beating each other up, and it's super violent. And, you know, we get a lot of slow-mo action. So I think that really helps kind of sell the old kind of West vibe of how they, you know, choreograph the action scenes, which I thought was kind of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's pushing people through big saloon windows and pumping people over the top of bars and all this kind of stuff.
And breaking chairs and bottles and those things. So all of that was really fun. But, you know, when those things happen, it's a really great build to then, you know, it becoming more and more real, because we get a lot of scenes of our guys doing these things, it all kind of being part of the fun, part of the game. So when that shift happens, it's very hard for them to tell right away.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's not quite as good a Western bar fight as one particularly notable Western bar fight, and perhaps the best Western bar fight in all Western bar fights, the one in Destry Rides Again, where Marlena Dietrich just goes absolutely insane.
Yes.
And throws herself around everywhere, and it is just such a great bar fight. Also, I'd just like to point out, rather interestingly, our chief supervisor and scientist of Delos, the guy who feels very confident about, you know, it all getting to be okay again. Just quite interestingly, he's played by a man with the last name of Oppenheimer,
yeah.
which I just think is interesting.
Yes.
No, for no reason specifically. I just think that's interesting. Yes.
Just this creator of something very kind of epic.
Yeah.
To have.
I think it's all going to be okay, really. It might not be. I know it's definitely all going to be okay.
Yes.
Okay, Oppenheimer.
Yeah. But it is not okay. It is not fine. So okay. I think, isn't it right after the snake bite? And then I think, is it the bar brawl that kind of goes a little crazy?
I think so, yes. But really, it's kind of the third or fourth time where Eubrina shows up. It is the bar fight when everybody goes crazy.
And so they kind of barely get out of there. Yeah.
Don't they? And then they go to bed and wake up the next morning to virtually nobody else in Westworld. Like, all the robots, something has happened. We know there's been a malfunction at this point because we've seen this happen in Roman world and in medieval world. I mean, we've seen a little bit more of medieval world as well, because there's a guy we are semi-following who is living out medieval world, who is the abbot from Robin Hood Men in Tights. We like
him.
We do like him.
Yeah.
That guy. But he has a malfunction with, I think, one of the serving women in the castle he's living in, who he's trying to have his way with, but she won't let him. And it's the behind the scenes people are watching this on all the cameras and the microphones that they've got set up secretly everywhere, going, oh, we've got a malfunction here. She won't let him have his way with her.
Yes. What's like, he's going able on to here? Do whatever is, scenario he wants. Yes.
Yeah. Which again is just a little bit terrifying, and I don't like the idea of just going somewhere and allowing this
and wanting to do people, that.
Yes, even people who look like human beings, it's just a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But there's that going on, and we see full malfunction in those other worlds, and it kind of get really, really crazy. Like, there's a lot of killing, there's an awful lot of killing.
Yeah.
And we see this happen before we see James Brolin and Richard Benjamin wake back up, go outside to virtually nobody else there.
They're super confused. They don't know what's going on.
This, I thought, was the most hilarious scene in the movie, is when Yul Brynner just struts back out and James Brolin just goes, oh,
not you again.
Come on,
not now. Like, we're trying to figure out what's going on. How do we get out of here?
Tired.
Where is everybody? We're tired. We're not trying to do all this.
And Yul Brynner's obviously just so programmed as the robot he is to do this all the time. But it's like the fourth time he's done it now.
And they're just fed up, especially because they just don't know what's going on. They're tired. They couldn't make it back, so they didn't, you know, they didn't sleep well. So they're just like, yeah, we need to get out of this place. And yeah, here he comes strutting up with his hands on his belt, just strutting. And he does the whole spiel, like, come on, you know, let's draw. And so,
come on, big man.
And usually it's Richard Benjamin who takes him on. And so this time, James Brolin is just kind of like, it's okay, buddy, I'll do it. And so the draw happens and James Brolin gets shot.
Yeah.
And he turns around and he looks at his friend. He's like, he shot me. And then he gets shot again and he just falls to the floor dead. And Richard Benjamin's just like, wait, what's going on? He looks at it. He thinks maybe he's joking or something, because they've already kind of tested it. Because Richard Benjamin, one of his many questions, you know, if these are real bullets, how can we not shoot each other by accident? He's like, go ahead, shoot me. He points the gun at him. He shoots it. Nothing happens. I guess the guns like have these thermal sensors or whatever, so they won't shoot anything that has like a warm sensor around it. So
you're only allowed to shoot the cold, heartless metal.
Exactly. So the fact that this happens, Richard Benjamin like starts freaking out. His friend is dead, and now here becomes our chase with him and the gunslinger. Terminator.
Yes, the gunslinger Terminator, because Yul Brynner does quickly turn into the Terminator. He's not in the movie, like, up until this last sort of half an hour. He only does pop up in these little fight scenes, because I've always, you know, pictured and known Westworld. Oh, yeah, Yul Brynner is that.
Yeah, it's his face, his robotic face on the cover, on the imagery of everything you see for this. Yeah.
And we get wonderful scenes. I mean, there's great effects in this movie as well, by the way.
Oh, yeah, with his face coming off and all of that kind of thing. Yeah. Looks great.
Looking behind Yul Brynner's face, because he gets, obviously, a bit of repair work done to him. Before any of the big malfunction happens, and they take his face off and look at all the metal robotics going on behind
his face. Yeah.
It looks great.
So good.
It's also very interestingly something I figured out only after watching the movie. This movie has the first ever use in a movie of any form of CGI, like actual computer graphic imagery within the movie itself, not an overlay, not any sort of, you know,
camera different trickery. Thing
actually within the movie. And it's the gunslinger's POV, that pixelated thermal scan of people, is the first ever use of movie CGI.
Wow, that's really cool.
Which is stunning. I think, I mean, it's incredibly rudimentary, but it is, you know, this movie now has become, I knew this movie was an important movie anyway, well-loved movie, seminal piece of 70s sci-fi, but that is such a integral part of the development of movie effects history, for this to be the first CGI inclusion. And obviously that the kind of thermal scan of a villain has been done, was it in Terminator? No, obviously Predator has a thermal scan.
Yeah.
Am I misremembering Terminator? Does the Terminator have a thermal scan?
I don't think he has a thermal scan, but he does have like the kind of graphic scan of like target.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering. That's right.
That sort of thing. But that the Terminator-ish POV of a relentless villain just with one thing in his mind going after our lead character, essentially. And we're seeing it sometimes from their POV and having it be this in Westworld, the first bit of CGI. So I like that.
Very cool. Well, thank you for dropping that factor. That's really cool. Yeah, and so the kind of chase is on, and Yul Brynner, very much like a Terminator, like a slasher, he's not really changing his pace. He's still strutting, still got his hands just leaned up on his belt buckle as he's like strutting. It was very much giving me like Danny and Sandy vibes. Like, I got chills. Like, do as he's just like walking, strutting to get Richard Benjamin. It's very kind of comical just when you think about it, just how he's walking. But as the chase continues, it does get a little bit more and more scary because Richard Benjamin's just like, what's going on? He's already trying to figure out what happened. His friend has just died, and he has no time to really consider how he's going to get out of here. He ends up kind of finding some horses and trying to sneak away with Yul Brynner like right on his tail.
You've just brought it up there. I think it does have quite a good pounding music to it as well, this movie, particularly in this whole chase. Yeah. Yes. Okay, it is a little bit funny how Yul Brynner's walking around. It is. I'm not saying it doesn't remind me of the end of Grease, because I would agree with you on that. I just want to see now Yul Brynner as the gunslinger be edited into some sort of Grease montage. And just get rid of Travolta. Just put Yul Brynner.
Just put Yul Brynner in there, yes.
There, dancing, just doing his little hands on the waist strut walk.
Yes.
That he does, because he barely runs in the movie. I mean, yes, he gets on a horse himself and does some horsing around, galloping around, but he barely runs. It's very Michael Myers. It's very constant walking everywhere in this just fast, methodical, steely-eyed kind of way. I mean, does anybody do steely-eyed determination quite like Yul Brynner? He has such a face for it, doesn't he? Such a persona for it.
Just a scowl, a straight scowl almost. Like, he doesn't have to do much for his face to look sinister, you know.
And a simplicity to his line delivery that you would get from a robot of this kind anyway, but it just has that quality to it that just works perfectly. And yes, sure, it's Yul Brynner's exotic accent that's doing all the work.
Yeah,
it is. But this is called good casting and good simple performance, because this sort of stuff isn't easy to do believably. It's easy to do comedically, I think.
Yeah, like as a character,
you are getting somebody. Yeah, you are getting somebody of the quality of actor of Yul Brynner to play in what is essentially a small, nasty sci-fi movie. And in a small role where he doesn't really have to do a great deal, yet it's clear he knows what he has to do, and he will do it absolutely perfectly, because he is the Terminator in this movie. Yes, we get the Terminator as the Terminator and Schwarzenegger doing all that great stuff that he obviously does in 1984. But Yul Brynner, you know, you've got to assume he may have looked at Yul Brynner in Westworld and gone, yeah, okay, I know I need to be simple here, but this, you know, this kind of thing is what I should be doing. Or at least, you know, they've looked at it when they're making Terminator and gone, Arnold, please do this.
Yeah.
Because it's very simple.
Look to this. Yeah, look to this as inspiration. But yeah, I mean, the chase kind of continues. It intensifies. I like when he runs into one of the techs out there, like trying to fix something. And he's very much in a rushed explanation to Richard Benjamin, like, oh yeah, there's a malfunction with the robots. You know, if one's chasing you, he's probably going to get you. That's how we designed them. So nothing really we can do about it. You know,
he does panic.
Yes. He gives him a couple of tips, like, you know, you can kind of try to mess with their targeting system. But other than that, like, sorry, guy, like, you know, you can distract them with sounds. But other than that, like, I don't know what you're going to do. If he is determined to kill you, he's going to kill you. So, you know,
get out of here now. Yeah.
He's like, but he's even like, I don't think you're going to make it. And Richard Benjamin just kind of has this cool response. Oh, yes, I will. And then he like rides his horse off. And I'm like, okay, get it. Like, I loved kind of his determination in that moment. Like, he's not giving up. He hasn't even really had time to process what's happening to him. And with this like squirrely guy telling him, oh, yeah, if he's going to kill you, he's going to kill you. We made them too good. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. And he's just like, oh, yes, I can get away. And so I loved that determination, that moment. He just rides off with this cool mustache like, oh, okay, I was into
can,
it.
Can I just say, sometimes I just love how different we are. And I think it's what makes this show great in how we differently view movies. You're viewing that as Richard Benjamin. I'm viewing that as you complete idiot, Richard Benjamin. What are you doing? You're not going to get away. You might as well follow this dude out, who's panicking to all hell in his little golf buggy car.
Yeah, that he's changing out his tire, so he's trying to like get the tire changed so he can get out of there. And so
that man is appropriately panicking because he knows the consequence of this malfunction. He works at Delos. He knows what's going on. He's like, oh god, you're a guest. Oh, sorry, you're dead. What? I don't want to be dead. He's like, no, you're just going to have to try and get out, but I don't think you're going to get out. If he wants you, then he's got you. Sorry, bye. And then he has to bolt it out there in his little golf buggy thing.
Yeah, so
that's
as soon as he kind of gets...
you should be having, run away.
Well, so Richard Benjamin, you know, after his kind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to get away, he rides off heroically, and here comes, and the guy...
Idiotically heroically.
And the worker gets into his little buggy after he fixes the tire, and as soon as he gets in the buggy, boom, boom, here comes Yul Brynner and shoots him dead. So just the brutality, like, that's not even like the main person he's after, but he sees human life, he's just going to kill it. So then I like that's just right there for us to see, okay, we already saw him kill the friend in cold blood. Now we think maybe he's just after Richard Benjamin because they've had this kind of tete-a-tete the whole time, even though like that's his programming. So maybe his program is just telling him to go after him. But when we see him now kill the actual worker, then we know how severe this malfunction is even more. It just heightens the stakes a little bit in that moment. And then the kind of chase continues on horseback now as Richard Benjamin, like, he's trying to follow signs and figure out how to get out of there. He ultimately makes it to, I think, the Roman land. And we see all of the dead bodies of people that have been killed. So it's literally just a bunch of bodies laying around. There's nobody there. He's kind of running through, trying to get out. He finds this manhole. He gets in, and then here comes Yul Brynner just strutting a couple steps behind.
Following his footsteps on his little POV CGI scanny thing.
Yes. And now he's kind of in the facility, and he's trying to find his way around. And at this point, the scientists are all like in, you know, the control room trying to figure things out. They see the malfunctions happened, and so they don't know how to stop it. All of their little fail safes aren't working, so then they get the idea to just shut down all the power. But shutting down the power ends up kind of shutting all the doors on them, and they overheat. So then when Richard Benjamin comes upon them, he looks into the window of the door and sees all of them passed out dead, seemingly dying because of the suffocation, being locked in that hot room and not being able to get out.
Idiots.
So now there's no one to help him. He's on his own. he just has this little bit of information. Okay, if I mess with, you know, his kind of targeting systems, if I, you know, distract him with sounds. So then he kind of has to set up his kind of makeshift attack on this gunslinger who's just hell-bent on killing him. No ability to reason with him, anything. Like all the things Michael Biehn said in Terminator, you can't reason with it, all of that is basically what Richard Benjamin and his little mustache is up to contending with. So
and his little mustache that has a sentience of its own and does its own thing.
It's his backup. Since James Brolin died, he's all he's got is the mustache now. His mustache.
All
buddy.
I can think of now is just Richard Benjamin's mustache having its own pistol that appears out of one of his nostrils.
Right?
And
yes.
Just goes, I'm here. I'm a little mustache. I'm going to kill you, you old Britta.
Yes.
Well, he needs the help.
He needs the help since you have no faith in him.
But there's I don't have any faith in him. There's something else that is so very Jurassic Park as well, though. And I mean, it just begs the question as to why Michael Crichton just did the same thing twice. In a little bit of a different way, sure. But like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, obviously, if you stand still, they can't see you. Like, that's not real to do with dinosaurs, obviously, but you know, it's a Jurassic Park dinosaur mentality, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's okay if we stand very still, she can't see us. You get Sam Neill giving it all the arms wide situation, protecting everybody, going
very convincing.
We can't. They can't see us if you just stand still. Oh no, yes, they can see you. Oh, and it's all like that. Chaos. So you get told these little things that happen. It's okay. You know, if you don't make, you can fudge the sound, you can mess with their scans and all this kind of stuff. But really, can you? I mean, they try. Yes.
I mean, as you say. They give you these rules. So you have to kind of let the movie adhere to those rules. And that's what they're telling us can be done. So that's what should be done. So, you know, Richard Benjamin he's able to fend off Yul Brynner. I think he sets him on fire. I would have liked this fight between the two of them to kind of last a little bit longer, have a little bit more back and forth, because I mean, the chase I think was solid up to the point when he gets to the facility. And then from there, it kind of loses the intensity that it had kind of leading up to him getting to the facility.
Really like this. I actually really like it. I like the fact that we're watching two people in Western clothing walk through a Roman garden and then into a medieval castle. Perhaps I just like that kind of historical anachronism going on.
It reminds you where you are. It kind of, you know...
It would be like
it reminds you of kind of the movement of the story, the characters removed from one place to another. So I like that it shows kind of the shift in how vast this whole kind of setup is.
It would be like, you know, one of the cast members of Disneyland from Frontierland accidentally wandering into Fantasyland and it being a little bit confusing as to why there's a cowboy wandering around Cinderella's castle.
Yes.
It's very similar in that sense. But no, I like when they go down that manhole in Roman world that they find and into all the operation chambers and large metal corridors. I mean, it reminds me of the idea of a kind of liminal spaces, the terrifying, long, huge corridors where nothing really is going on. There's a sense of dread. There's you can't find your way out. This is just endless. Almost like the end of Jordan Peele's Us as well, when you go behind the mirror thing and it's all that huge corridors of nothingness and you get really confused as to what's going on. You can't get out. You just feel trapped in vastness at this point. And I feel like this is the Delos facility in this movie at the end. Richard Benjamin, to me, feels trapped in in massive space because you're constantly hearing the clunk, clunk, clunk of Yul Brynner's boots behind him.
But you don't know what direction is right. Everything looks the same. But he ultimately does find himself in the medieval castle, and that's kind of where the whole thing, you know, ends.
But before this, he's already thrown acid on Yul Brynner's face to try and mess up. He's kind of hidden himself and pretended he was one of the malfunctioned robots on one of these operating tables.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Yul Brynner's walking past and he turns around, but he's found some acid somewhere and thrown that on Yul Brynner's face, and this kind of half melts away Yul Brynner's face. That's a really good makeup job when you see him 2 minutes after he's got this kind of half melted face.
Yeah.
He's great, but it kind of does mess up and twinge a little bit of his circuiting. So he is kind of a little bit messed up with his thermal scans at this point. And he's trying, Yul Brynner. He's still trying to do what he should be doing and killing Richard Benjamin. but he's
struggling now. Yeah.
He's a little bit twitchy. They do end up in the medieval castle. I think we see the abbot from Men in Tights dead as well at this point.
Okay.
And there is this final fight, but I mean, you said this final fight is a little bit underwhelming. Maybe I just like it.
Yeah,
for the
nastiness
of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he sets him on fire and he thinks he's kind of won. He runs into the girl and he thinks she's a real girl. So he, you know, she's all in distress. He gives her water at her kind of protest, but then she was only protesting the water because she was a robot too. Oh, and she's sparking and short circuiting. So now he's like really alone. And here comes back all melted Yul Brynner to still try to attack him. And so then they kind of struggle for a little bit before he is able to fully kind of take him down. Yeah. And then he kind of blows up.
Well, when Yul Brynner gets set on fire, it's again, this really quite good stunt of clearly a man walking around in a big flame suit that's crazy looking thing.
Yeah.
But he comes back and he's just all char. He's just this charred body. Now, at this point, you're still trying to kind of very robotic movement.
Yeah.
He's still trying to do it. His face falls off. I love it when his face falls off. This is the very end of the movie, but his face falls off and you just see this horror hollow thing behind the human face.
And
Richard Benjamin has to look into it, and it is nasty. I mean, if you watch this movie on that underlayer of morals and ethics and people and uncanny valley situations, you are realizing that this is a really good horror sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting horror sci-fi. It's a simple movie. It's a straightforward movie. But as an idea, it's perfect, isn't it? It's so interesting.
It's such a good base idea that I think even a worse execution than this could still, you know, prompt some interesting visuals and interesting plot points for these characters, because it's just such a good idea. But I think this execution for its small budget really was able to tell a fun story with some intensity and really have this interesting juxtaposition of the fun of the world, really have you live in it, feel it, show how people were experiencing it. And then it takes that really interesting shift. You know, at a certain point, you don't really need it to tell you why, because you're just kind of just like the character, like the scientists don't know why, the guests don't know why. So then at a certain point, like, we don't really need to know why. So that's why the show is so interesting, in the fact that they do kind of delve into a deeper thing of the why. But, you know, we don't, in the story that they give us, we don't really need that. So it's just a really tight story, really well set up. And I think a solid delivery of a very interesting, cool premise.
It really, really is. I echo entirely what you've just said. You don't need the addition that the TV show would give you, but, you know, because that's not how this movie is presented, yet I think it's good that it's clearly worthwhile that TV show exists, basically.
Yeah.
Because it delves into the same ideas and just goes much deeper into them. And you say it may have got a little confusing and complex and, you know, maybe overindulgent. But we can forgive a little bit of that because it's easy to do something like that with an idea like this. You can go deep into those moral questions and even get into the psyche of the robots themselves. You know, are we human? We are so like human. Does it become Blade Runner? You know, where we are so like human that we now want to be human. Give me life, you know, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe I was expecting a little bit of that in Westworld. We didn't get any of that at all. We didn't get any...
Yeah, we didn't get any of the robots questioning themselves, wanting to be more. And it's kind of... Because I think on the surface, if you didn't really know the plot and just maybe knew something about the show or just the general idea, your thought would be the robots become sentient. They're angry that, you know, humans made them. And they want to be in control and take over. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
But this movie doesn't really get into that. They just have this malfunction and that's what happens. We don't get into any deeper kind of artificial feeling from these things about their lack of humanity or their need to be more human or anything like that, which is what we've seen quite a bit through this series, particularly on our Morgan Hasn't Seen movies. So, like you kind of expect it to go there, and when it doesn't, it just... you know, adds to kind of the simplicity of the story. So,
yeah, but effectiveness of it, because it just wants to be a simple, effective story and works as that. Yes. Westworld, 1973, great slice of 70s sci-fi, has opened me up, Janine, to watching more 70s sci-fi that I have missed, because it's surprisingly a little bit of a blind spot for me is this era of early 70s sci-fi. I've watched a small few.
Yeah, me too. But nothing.
Really some big name sci-fi movies from that era that I'm still lacking on. This was one of them. I'm very glad we've covered it on this episode of It's a Wonderful Podcast, as maybe unusual as an It's a Wonderful Podcast movie as it might be.
Yes. Would you want to read the book? Have you read the book?
I haven't. No, I think I would. Maybe that would delve deeper, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's tough to say. I would do. I definitely would do. I'd buy this movie in a nice big set, you know, a nice big edition. I would, because I think it's a fun movie. It's an important movie. And I think it would just look great in some sort of remastered version.
Okay.
And I would watch it frequently. I think it's just an entertaining, nasty little thing of a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
And I like that kind of thing. You know, I like that kind of thing.
Yes. Yes. Of course. Yeah.
But yes. There we go for this episode of It's a Wonderful Podcast. We are back next week. We're going even later. We're 2 years after this movie. After this year's movie. What are words? Is that what I meant? You know what I mean?
2 years after the release of this movie.
Correct. When we are talking The Stepford Wives next week.
A little deja vu action.
Little bit of a deja vu, yes, of course, but with that 1975 movie. And, of course, we're back. Morgan Hasn't Seen Cyborg Sci-Fi as well to close that out with Blade Runner 2049 next week. We talked Blade Runner, the final cut, specifically, on this week's episode on Wednesday. So go and check that out if you haven't already. I hope you've been enjoying the cyborg sci-fi-ness. I certainly have on both shows all month long. It's been a wonderful area to get into and delve deep. Get your mind working. Get your thinking about all the craziness that AI could bring us. Yes. As terrifying as it is, truly. We don't want malfunctions and some sort of modern-day AI equivalent of Yul Brynner coming and destroying us all, because that's just in the programming. Yeah. I don't want that.
No, thanks.
We don't want that. We should be stopped now and not taken any further before. All those people should be watching movies like this and should be watching Frankenstein, although that's obviously not a robot movie, but all those playing God moral tales.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Terminator 2. Yeah.
Terminator
2. Skynet. Miles Dyson.
Everything. Miles Dyson, everything. Yes, watch all those and realize that you are them, you idiot. Stop it. Human beings are human beings. Anyway, enough going on about that sort of philosophy. We've done that plenty, and we will continue to be doing that as well. Morgan hasn't seen And It's a Wonderful Podcast Wednesdays and Fridays on the It's a Wonderful Podcast feed. Subscribe on all major podcast platforms wherever you are listening. Answer those little questions we put on Spotify. We spoke about the Patreon and the donation links that you can find in the description. Before, you can also subscribe, ding the notification bell on the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel. Of course, we had this month's video episode on RoboCop, which was last week's Morgan Hasn't Seen. Go up there as well. So check out the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel, of course, or you can just find us on social media, on Twitter at It's a Wonderful One. You can find me on Twitter at The Purple Dawn with a 3 instead of the E in the because, Janine.
3 is the magic number.
On Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at The Purple Dawn. All your Westworldy stuff is where.
Western worldy stuff.
Western world. Sorry, Delos. Western world.
You can find me at Janine Devine _ on Twitter, Janine Devine on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, just check the description for the link or search It's Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop, g9design.bigcartel.com.
Yul Brynner, Yul Brynner, Yul Brynner.
Oh, no. I can't do that.
Nobody can do that. I can't do it. I'm sure I tried doing it last week, and it sounded like Martin Landau playing Bela Lugosi.
His like Swiss-Russian mishmash Swiss, of things.
Swiss. It's definitely Swiss. A bit Russian. Where's he from?
I think he's Russian. I believe he's Russian and Swiss, and he has said that there's Mongolian mixed in there, but like, I don't know if that was just
that
a claim.
That was just to get away with
those characters he's played. He's also had thrown Japanese in there when he was doing Tell People. I looked it up. So I do believe it's Russian. He was born in Russia, but I think like one of his parents is Swiss.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. He's basically apparently from everywhere. So
yes, yeah.
That's too complex. I'd just like to point out it's too complex to read out now.
Okay, all right. Well, I will attempt. I don't know if it would be bad, but 3, 2, 1.
Bye.
Bye.